Welcome to Acre Interview. I'm Mike, I'm your host, and this podcast is with Roger Cruikshank. Roger chats about flying the mighty RAF Typhoon, the Hawk, and his own personal dealings with mental health. So if you like what we do here, head over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us out for as little as $1 per month. Also, visit us at aircrewinterview.tv to watch all of our other interviews and sign up to our newsletter. Please enjoy.
Yeah, so aviation for me was probably, when I was young, it was anything to do with that was fast and had an engine I was intrigued by. So that's definitely how I got into it. And also my dad was a big lover of World War One and World War Two aircraft, and he was always, you know, watching telly with World War Two dogfights and things like that. And I think that's what kind of pulled me into it and gave me the interest at an early age.
When was your first flying experience?
So for me, it was my sister and I went for our first shot in a glider, and that was at Dinnet, which was just to the east of Boyne Academy. And we went there, and it was a bit of an introductory thing because I was always saying to my dad and my mum, "Oh, I really want to be a pilot," you know, always had done. So I said, "Okay, well, let's go and see how you fare in an aircraft in a glider." But I remember it really well because I was very jealous when I landed, and I think after 26 minutes, something like that. And it was a really good flight, really enjoyed it. And I was like, yep, got the bug, I love flying. So, you know, straight away. And my sister was all the way over to Loch Nagar, went about 5,000 feet higher than me, and was airborne for about an hour 15. So yeah, that was my first taste. I had a bit of an interesting beginning to my Air Force career because of my skiing. So I was effectively a professional skier before I actually joined the Air Force. So when I joined in 2001, I was actually in the full-time British ski team. So I had done a full-time season with the team, and it was going really well. But then it got to the point where my parents were nearly bankrupt because of skiing. There's no real money in it. And I always wanted to be a pilot. So I had this, you know, I really wanted to go for the job and go for the dream job. So, so I committed, I had to just leave the skiing behind. But then luckily the Air Force, when I got through officer training, successfully completed that, I was about to start flying training, and then they gave me the opportunity to go out to the RAF Ski Championships, and then did really well there. And they said, okay, well, we want you to try and beat the Army. So they brought me along to the inter-services as part of the team. And then again, luckily did really well. You know, that's what I was doing professionally before. So from there, they then said, oh, well, actually, let's, because of this, they had delayed my flying training. And then after that, the inter-services, some of the senior officers came up to me and asked, you know, why I wasn't still continuing skiing. And I told them about, you know, what happened, and, you know, we ran out of money, basically. I wasn't able to continue it, but I've always wanted to do this job, so here I am. And the RAF, the Chief Air Staff, actually granted me a four-year sabbatical to then race in the Olympics. So at that point, I went into the kind of full-time British ski team, still working, and I was actually involved in organising the Lucas Air Show for about 4 years. So that was the job I was doing when I was home, but then I was continually training with the British ski team, and then managed to compete in the 2006 Olympics, and then I went into flying training straight after that, and then started flying training at Witten on the Grob Tutor.
Like an action man.
For sure.
So what did you fly, your basic training, and how long did you fly for?
Yeah, sure. So for the basic training, so the elementary flying training at RAF Witten on the Grob Tutor, and that was an awesome bit of kit. You know, you could cartwheel the thing. It was such a maneuverable, or is such a maneuverable aircraft. And now, I mean, you know, it could be done with glass cockpit and all that. But to be honest, at that elementary stage, I think it's just perfect the way it is. So yeah, really fun aircraft to fly, and I've got fond memories of that thing. Yeah, so, epic. I absolutely love the Hawk T1, and I actually did 5 years in it, and about 750 hours on it, I think. So I managed to get a passenger flight in the back of one about a year before I actually started the training. So at that point, my dream was purely just to fly solo in a Hawk. That's all I ever wanted to do. And then, of course, when I got there, then I just wanted to do more and more, and, you know, get better and better, and then further, and then onto the Typhoon. You know, there's the kind of ambition grew. But yeah, an awesome bit of kit, And it's probably worth talking about now to compare it to the Typhoon, where you see you get the Hawk T1, which is, you know, very much like a little kit car. You know, it's very raw, you know, the braking, the controlling, you feel everything, all the buffet through the wing, the energy management is very obvious, the way the wing handles, really. And then you compare that to the Typhoon, which actually you're in buffet most of the time, just because of the big delta wing. And you don't get a huge amount of feedback on the Typhoon, but then because of the huge amount of power, it makes the Typhoon an absolute beast to fly, a really amazing aircraft to fly, because all the information as well. You know, back to the Hawk, which has got no computers whatsoever, and that again is the beauty of it, because it's such a basic aircraft. You just throw the switches forward, get airborne, and take it from there.
Roger chats about flying the RAF frontline fighter, the Typhoon.
Sure, so yeah, after the Hawk, because I did about, like I was saying, about 5 years at RAF Valley, the magical island of dreams that is Anglesey, and then went on to the Eurofighter Typhoon after, luckily, a successful advanced weapons training course. So yeah, from there onto Typhoon. So that was in about April 2013, and I had, you know, achieved that ambition. I've always wanted to fly a Typhoon. So even to be sitting in ground school learning all about it, I was absolutely fascinated and really excited about the adventure on the Typhoon.
So that's what you always wanted to fly?
Yeah, absolutely. Ever since I knew about it, I remember playing that game, EF 2000, that computer game. You know, because I think when I was young, I remember trying to convince my dad to let me buy a computer or some console or something. He was never very keen, but then actually, I think he's glad that he let me do it, because, you know, the eye-hand coordination and just getting immersed in the flying world. I remember, you know, dogfighting when I was whatever age it was, you know, using these computer games. And actually, that's how I got into it in the first place. So that's what kind of set the ambition. And then just knowing all about this new exciting aircraft and always wanting to fly that.
So when did your training on the Typhoon start, and how long did it take?
Yeah, so it was April 2013, and the training itself was about 6 months. So you've got the initial ground school process, obviously, to go through and learn about all the millions of computers that are in the aircraft, and figuring out how it all connects, really. And then from there, going on to the process with the simulator and learning to fly the thing in the simulator, and then before you actually obviously get airborne on your first solo trip.
So how did you find the simulator?
Yeah, awesome actually. And at RAF Coningsby, they've got the full motion simulator, so the FMS, where you're effectively in a bubble. So you can actually look almost all around you, not so much over behind you, not directly behind you, but it gives you this really good feel. And actually, the most bizarre thing is if you're standing in there, you're not actually sitting and flying, but if you're standing in, you have to hold on. Otherwise, you will fall over, because the visuals make you actually think that you're getting chucked around and going inverted, when actually you're just standing like this. So yeah, it's an impressive bit of kit.
Sounds
it really
like
is.
That video game.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So what was your first trip like?
Oh, it was awesome. I remember it well. On my first one, the first two trips were with an instructor in the back, and you know, it was really so good to be flying this thing, which just had so much power, and nice to see the computers, you know, in action, and getting that you know, having that moving map and all this information that I never had before in the Hawk T1, and getting used to using the radar, for example, and then, you know, fast forward onto my first solo trip, which was only, you know, a few days later, and so it was my third trip in the Typhoon, was on my own. And I remember I had a perfectly clean jet, so nothing hanging off it, you know, no missiles, no tanks, and it was just me in this fighter. And the power, you know, as it blasts you down the runway, it was just something else. And I'll never forget that, because, you know, the Hawk T1, plenty of flying experience on that in jets and getting used to the speed, but not ever having that amount of excess power that the Typhoon has. So yeah, it was something else.
So how did the Hawk, get you ready for the Typhoon? Because obviously it was no glass cockpit, did it?
Yeah, it's a good question, because it's with the Hawk T2, it's a bit of an easier jump, you know, to come from something that is glass cockpit, and it's got all this information as well. But like you say, the Hawk T1 didn't have anything at all apart from a bolt-on GPS that you put into the top of the instrument panel, which, you know, was helpful and did the job, but nowhere near the Typhoon. Yeah. But the Hawk T1, what was really good was getting your airmanship skills, you know, and just knowing how to fly without having to actually depend, because you can depend on the radar too much and depend on this and the moving map, where actually you need to be looking out and trying to, you know, get your head around the battle space, really, as you know, the airspace, but really thinking military wise, you know, the battle space and what's around you rather than just depending on what the kit is telling you.
So was the back of the two-seat Typhoon, was it mirrored to the front?
Yeah, exactly that. It's not got every switch that it has in the front, but mostly everything in the back. So, and you can fly it from the back, obviously, as well, quite easily, although the view is not very good. They've got a repeater and the head-up display, so you can actually see kind of through the camera what is being seen out the front. So it makes it easier to land, you know, from the back, for example. But it's not great, you know, it's not really designed for that. It's designed as a bit of a backup thing if the instructor needs to land when the guy in the front makes makes some mistakes.
So what was it like coming from the Hawk and then the first time putting it into reheat?
Oh, just awesome. And it's still, I do now when I fly the Typhoon, is go down to low level, as low as I can go over the sea, and come all the way back to as slow as it'll go, which is, you know, it's only like 110 knots. You can be lucky if you get that slow, and then just kick and reheat. And the thing, it accelerates like being on a motorbike until you would get up to the speed of sound. You know, it really is an impressive bit of kit, and you can just stay there, and it really is, that is the best way to show off the power. And also if you're doing a performance takeoff or a QRA takeoff where you want to get, you know, off the ground as quick as possible, and you use max reheat, I mean, it just surprises me every time how much power there is. And that's, you know, for example, with the performance takeoff, you go reheat and then you stick it onto its back, and it's just the weirdest sensation when you're still going up and you're looking out and you're completely on your back. You know, it's just incredible the amount of power that is in this thing. But still so easy to handle as well.
So when was the first time you went supersonic?
Yeah, it's probably on the first trip, actually, where you get to really appreciate what the aircraft can do. So they try and show you the different aspects of the jet. But to be honest, you know, it was a big event, I guess, to begin with. And then the more you do it, you know, most times we fly, we'll go super well. It depends on what role we're doing. But if we're doing air-to-air fighting, then we'll go supersonic most of the time. You become very much, it's just a number to you, to be honest. Still appreciate it every time.
So, going back to training, what kind of missions did you actually do for training sorties?
So to begin with, it was all about, obviously, learn the aircraft, but then that happens, you know, very quickly, and then you're moving on to QRA profiles, the quick reaction alert profiles, so that you can be, you know, used for what is the primary aim of the Typhoon, defending the country's airspace. And then from there, on the course, you'll have a look at air-to-air, so defensive counter-air profiles, offensive counter-air profiles, and start to look at those and how we operate in, you know, our main training environment for air-to-air. But of course, air-to-surface being very important now as well, and we're introduced to that on the course on the Operation Conversion Unit, where they introduce you into it, so you get a bit of exposure. Because very quickly, as you hit the front line, then you need to be multi-role combat ready, so that you are able to deploy for whatever situation arises. Because as you know, these days we are fighting all sorts around the globe. So. Sure, so, you know, with the Eurofighter Typhoon, going from the Hawk T1 into this aircraft with all this information available to you, it was certainly a case of knowing where to look at the right time. So trying to not just learn the layout of the cockpit, but all the buttons available to you as well. So on the HOTAS, the hands-off throttle and stick, which is just an epic, you know, bit of kit itself, because you've almost got, it's something like 50 to 60 button selections just, you know, on those two controls, and with shift as well to give you even more. So you can actually do most of the flying of the aircraft just with your hands remaining on the throttle and stick, as the title suggests. But giving you the three MHD screens as well, to give you that kind of look down to get any bit of information. So you know, quite often for me, the way I'll have the cockpit laid out is the radar B scope on the left, and then in the middle I'll have my moving map, so my personal awareness screen, and then on the right I'll have the elevation format for my radar as well. So it gives you the where they are in relation to the ground of where the radar contacts are coming through. But of course that coupled with the head-up display. But now, not to forget the HMSS as well, so the helmet mounted symbology system, which is just an epic bit of kit because it really brings everything together. You know, so for example, if you are in a close air support environment and you need to target something on the ground, you know, we do a lot of this for training, like I was saying. So we can just look at it with the helmet and then with one button selection, place all our symbology over that. And then it'll bring, say, the Lightning 3 pod into that as well straight away. So all you have to do is finesse it, and then you can be, you know, for example, dropping a Paveway 4 on that within seconds. So it's a very excellent bit of kit, and the way it's all synchronized now and harmonized, it works really well. And I think to begin with, when I came onto the aircraft, it was there and it was starting, but we weren't getting using it, you know, so much. And it wasn't so important. Air to air was where it was at. But now, you know, we are a hugely confident multi-role platform, and we're showing that across the world, and we've got that reputation now as well, which is excellent.
So what was your first Typhoon Squadron?
First Typhoon Squadron was 29 Squadron for the Operation Conversion Unit, so obviously teaching it, but then straight on to 6 Squadron after that, which is the emblem there. So. From there, I've done a good 3 years with them, frontline, and been all over the world with them as well, actually, which has been a fantastic experience and a solid bunch of guys and girls in that squadron.
So what was the main role of 6 Squadron?
I mean, the main role, to be honest, for any Typhoon Squadron is really the quick reaction alert. And it does change, of course, depending on what comes up. But we've done things like, you know, the Baltic air policing out in Estonia. We were patrolling the Baltics, so we did a bit of that as a force. Many exercises as well. So we've been out to Red Flag. We did that as a squadron just the year before last. And then also went with 1 Squadron last year as well. So that has been, you know, fantastic to go and be such a big player in what is, you know, the biggest air-to-air. In fact, it's really multi-role mission out there now as well. So, yeah, it's been a fantastic experience.
So how many hours or times a week did you fly?
I think on the Typhoon, it really did change on what, you know, what we were working up towards, and depending on the amount of hours that we were given to achieve, you know, the task to go out onto whatever operation or detachment or exercise that we had. But really it would come down to flying about 2 or 3 times a week generally, to share out amongst all the pilots on the squadron. But with one flight, even if it's, for example, just an hour and 15, it could be that will actually take about 5-6 hours, because of the, you know, the end-to-end planning, to make sure that we treat it as if it is a live mission every single time, you know, that it is a real-time mission, trying to make it as realistic as possible.
So how many jets were on the squadron?
I think on 6th Squadron we had about 20 jets, but of course it would depend on the different engineering cycles whether they were available or not. And you know, in every engineering squadron would really, it would depend on how good they got on with the aircraft and how the fleet is doing as well. Because they might have to take different variants, because we've got the P1EB, which is the latest variant, and that's got the clearance for the Paveway 4, and it's really the best bit of kit that there is, or the best Typhoon variant there is at the moment. But that would get moved around, you know, for different operations and exercises coming up. So it would mean that, you know, it might get pulled off of 1 6. So it's not as if 6 Squadron had their own specific jets. They might do for a few months, but then it'll change around. But I have to say that I really do feel that we have the best engineers in the Air Force and 6 Squadron. They just did a fantastic job. I can say that now because I've left the squadron. But they really, you know, did a fantastic job. And it's amazing how much they kept the jets reliable for us. And we always achieved the task, you know, without fail. So impressive.
Roger chats about being on quick reaction alert.
So could you tell us what QRA is?
Yeah, so quick reaction alert is effectively us sitting around and being ready for, you know, 24/7 for any call out. So if we have the Russians coming from the north, or if we have an airliner that's coming in from any direction and maybe not talking to anyone, then we have to make sure that we get there. It's maybe not because they are, you know, doing anything bad, but we just really get airborne to go and help them if they need assistance. If they have had a complete communications failure, then actually we can be there to help them and assist them through that. And there's all obviously, you know, various protocols to depending on the situation that arises with what has happened with this airliner. And it's the same with the Russians, how, you know, quite often with other aircraft, they will put in a flight plan or they'll talk to someone, but they will quite often just come down because, you know, it is international airspace, but we have to make sure that they're not infringing on our, you know, our own domestic or sovereign airspace. So that's why we're sent up as well to assist them if they need it, just to shepherd them as well around the UK mainland.
So how many times have you been called off on QRF?
Quite a few, actually. I've been quite lucky, was the way I view it, in getting airborne and intercepting lots of different aircraft. So I've intercepted 22 different Russian aircraft. So I'll get this right. It was it's 10 Bears, a Blackjack, a Midas, the tanker, which was for the Blackjack, 4 Foxhounds, a Curl, and then 4 Fullbacks as well. So I've been, yeah, quite lucky with all those aircraft and all the intercepts, and, you know, experienced quite a lot of different things, you know, at different times. I think I've had one which was, you know, a nice lunchtime departure where they came down at kind of a gentlemanly like time, and then to a 3:30 in the morning where you're kind of getting pulled out of your bed, and then, you know, getting airborne to have to, which was quite an intensive initial picture where there's a lot of aircraft coming down from the north. But it's amazing experiences, and some of the stuff, like, I'll never forget seeing the Blackjack through the NVGs later on at night, or in the morning actually, and you know, looking through this thing and seeing this kind of green glowing big beast that I'd come up to intercept, and shepherding it round to the west. It was actually the one that went down to into the Med, and then came across to bomb Syria on its way through with its cruise missile. So that was a very interesting time for me, and to see that in the papers afterwards as well, what it actually got up to was really interesting as well.
So when that bell or siren goes, what goes through your mind?
The adrenaline spikes straight away, that's for sure, every single time, whether it's training or for real, because quite often you don't actually know if it's training or if it's for real. And then the first thing is just don't mess up, just keep to your training, I think. And that's what I always try and, you know, don't think too far ahead, just do what you're doing, do what you've been taught, and get into aircraft and just simply worry about getting the thing ready, you know, because like any computer, like your mobile phone, you know, quite often it just won't work. So you have to switch it off and switch it back on again. The Typhoon is very reliable, and actually, you know, most times, if not, yeah, just about every time I've had an on-time departure, you know, within our acceptable time. So yeah, it is definitely a case of getting an aircraft, getting it fired up, and then getting on the comms and worrying about where this aircraft actually is. So just getting airborne as quick as possible really is the main thing.
So does all your training kick in, or are you a bit nervous when it happens?
Oh, definitely a bit nervous every single time. The fear of failure is always quite a lot. You know, it's quite hard to fight off, and it were, which is what I talk about in my book, actually. Sorry to selfishly pluck it there. But, you know, just and that's what, you know, we talk about in the book, is the fear of failure and these feelings that go through, and actually talk about some specific, you know, QRA scrambles where you have got all these things going on. It can be early in the morning, but you just, yeah, stick to the training, because we've done it time and time again, and you've got to rely on that and rely almost on the instinct to keep you safe and to keep you doing the right thing. And, you know, it's worked most times. We made mistakes along the way, of course, everyone does. And I guess we have to accept that as well. But yeah, I mean, it's always a rush, that's for sure.
So do you ever train with other nations?
Yeah, we do actually, and quite a lot, which is really good. It helps us to, well, keep relations up, but also to see how other air forces are doing their business. And it means we can learn from them, I'm sure they learn from us, and we can, yeah, just work together as well, and come up with the best way to do business, you know, working as a team with other nations. So, you know, with America, for example, done a lot out in Red Flag. We did a bit with Sweden when we went to the Alpine Challenge exercise, and with Finland as well. And that was, you know, really good to fight some of their aircraft and for example, fight against the Gripen and the F-18. And then America, we've USAF, and yeah, we fought against F-16s, the F-15s. And, you know, it is very interesting. And I've always wanted to, you know, see an F-16 up close or to fight one and to actually do that for real. You know, I remember I fought one of the Top Gun instructors before I did the Red Flag exercise last year. And we never got to meet each other before. It was a telephone brief. And we never got to meet each other after, but it was a hell of a fight. You know, it was an amazing 1v1 kind of dogfighting experience. And luckily, because the Typhoon is a beast, you know, I came off well. But it was incredible to be flying alongside, because he was the formation leader for the recovery. So we just arrived in the airspace, we met each other, we had a fight, and then we terminated that and then joined back up, and he led me back into Nellis Air Force Base from there. But it was incredible to have him doing all the procedures of us joining up and me to be sitting on his wing in a Typhoon with him as F-16 and just kind of, you know, giving each other thumbs up. It was just an incredible experience, and especially because I'd, you know, done quite well against him as well, then, you know, it was really good. I mean, no excuse, the Typhoon is a beast and it's got so much excess power that it really is an amazing dogfighter, but an incredible experience.
Was it one of them cool camel F-16s?
No, it wasn't actually. No. Because, yeah, you're right, they have those for the, you know, to act as the aggressors on the aggressor squadron out there. But unfortunately not. Well, I say unfortunately not. It still looks really cool as it is. But it's really small, especially compared to Typhoon. You're looking at the big Delta wing and you look over to F-16 and it does look like, I mean, the guy was quite big. He just looked like Donkey Kong in his cockpit, you know. It was, but an impressive, really impressive. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So how do you fare against the Gripen and F-15, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, the Gripen as well is quite similar in a way to the F-16. It's single engine, so it's not got, you know, as much power. I mean, it's a very, very capable aircraft, but again, we've got the SEP, the specific excess power advantage, massive advantage compared to the weight of our aircraft. So that means that we're going to bleed off energy like any aircraft does, but actually we'll get it back up a lot quicker than a Gripen ever would, for example. So yeah, it was an excellent aircraft to fly against, and some of the guys on the exercise were able to fly with them as well and get a shot at low level with those guys, which is a lot lower than we ever go. And then, for example, the F-15. I've done some 1v2, so I was the red air for their 2v1 profile, so fighting against the two F-15s, and that was great fun. But again, the Typhoon is, you know, impressive in that they're trying to do the best they can to kind of, you know, pincer move me and to use their 2v1 tactics, which we are, you know, very well versed in as well. But I was just a raging red, you know, the bad guy trying to flick between the two. But the F-15 is such a huge aircraft that, you know, the Typhoon should outperform it in BFM as well, because it is a lot more maneuverable. But still, you know, the F-15 is a hugely capable aircraft and can carry, you know, so many armaments. And it's got, you know, very good radar, especially when they've got the ESA as well, or the, you know, the electronic version of the radar. It's a great bit of kit.
So how do other nations view the Typhoon?
I think we've got a fantastic reputation now, and I think we've earned that through our operations throughout the world, and, you know, that we're doing now and have done to kind of prove ourselves, but also from Red Flag, which is, you know, it's the biggest exercise in the world, and to have that and to showcase our multi-role platform. You know, I'll never forget when watching a debrief, and it was it was a friend of mine, one of the pilots who was doing an AI mission, so an air integration mission, where he was dropping a Paveway 4 for real within the exercise. You know, it was just on some target in the desert. So he successfully did that. But meanwhile, there was an air-to-air war raging on at the time. And he was able to successfully drop that Paveway 4. And then at the time, he was listening to the picture and heard that there was a red, you know, one of the aggressors, so one of the bad guys, just about getting out to the east to the mission fail line. But then luckily he managed to pick this up on his radar and fired, you know, an AMRAAM off, simulated obviously, and took this aircraft out just before it hit the line. But it just showed the platform, the incredible platform that Typhoon is with multi-role war. He was able to do that, drop pay before, you know, for real, as in within the training environment, but drop a live Pave 4 and then turn up and using the simulated, you know, radar was able to pick this aircraft up and Fox 3 before he got to that line, which was just great. And all the, you know, the Americans were like, oh yeah, this Typhoon, that's pretty impressive. Yeah, so yeah, we've got a great reputation and we're building as well as the Typhoon progresses as well through time with software uploads and just improvements as it gets more established.
So how long did you spend in Red Flag?
We were there for, I think it was about 5 weeks. So the exercise itself, I think, was about 2 weeks long. But then we had about a week of pre-exercise flying. We were, you know, doing things like flying with the Top Gun instructors out there and fighting against the F-16s or just doing various missions before and getting to know the airspace. And then we had a bit of time afterwards. And then, of course, when you bolt on the amount of time to trail the aircraft out, to actually fly them with the Voyager tankers out there and back, then you're talking about 5 weeks, yeah.
So what's it like tanking on a Typhoon? Is it easy?
It's never easy. And I don't think anyone will ever say that it's easy. Even, you know, even if you manage to not miss the basket for 10 times in a row, you just never talk about that, because the next time, Saw's Law, you'll miss it completely, yeah. or snap off your probe or something. So, I mean, it is a very nice aircraft to fly, but because of, for example, we've obviously got the probe that comes out to the right, and then because you've got the bow wave that comes over the front of the aircraft with the airflow, as soon as you get closer to the basket, then what happens is that bow wave actually pushes the basket out of the way. So you can't just, like you'd think, you know, like if you're driving a car, if you had a metal probe on the side of your car, you could probably, you know, I don't know, drive it into the back of another car. And it's the same sort of thing. But of course, you add in the aerodynamics where you're flying about 300-400 miles an hour, but, you know, say, yeah, you're probably going to be about 300 knots. So with that, and then trying to kind of add on a bit of turbulence as well. You know, I've definitely had some missions and some interesting QRA, you know, intercepts. Because obviously on QRA, when you're up there for about, it can be about 8 hours, then you want to make sure that you're getting the fuel on and you're staying above that fuel line, on top of that fuel line. But we've had some what we call pressure plugs when you get to that point where you're getting quite low on fuel and you're, you know, still worrying about where the aircraft are that you've got to go and pick up next. And when you get that coupled with turbulent conditions, then it can make for some interesting refueling. But again, the Typhoon is awesome. It's a very nice, stable aircraft to fly. So you just got to take your time and make sure you don't snap that probe off.
Roger chats about the Baltic Air Policing mission.
An excellent mission that I'll never forget was when we're doing the Baltic Air Policing out in Estonia. And from Amari, where we're based, we got rumours through the intelligence that there was possibly going to be some Russian aircraft coming around, and the you know, it was maybe going to be a case that we had to intercept them. But there wasn't a huge amount of information, and you know, it was just going to be having to wait and see what the air traffic, what their radars picked up. And then that was it. The buzzer went, and there we are. And we got the scramble message. They were going to send us up. We didn't know what aircraft it was going to be, but they had an idea that there's maybe going to be fighters. But we knew there was going to be a curl as well. So that was the initial one we got scrambled for, was a curl. We got airborne in 6 minutes, which is fantastic. It was great work from the engineers and my wingman as well. We got airborne within 6 minutes, wheels in the well, and then it was straight up, and we're actually on the wing of the curl within 12 minutes, which is, you know, a fantastic job from everyone involved. And then, you know, to be waving at the guy who was flying the curl was, you know, fantastic. He's doing his job, we were doing ours. And then from there, we then got another order that came up from our command and control C2 to say that there were some fighters coming as well. So we're like, oh, okay, all right. So this could be interesting, and it turned out it was we turned back because they were coming from the east, We were trying to conserve fuel as well, because they gave us some heads up that there could be other aircraft after the foxhounds as well. So we headed towards the foxhounds, and you know, being as fuel efficient as we could be, and getting up to heights and just being in a profile, we're ready. So we actually ended up just doing a CAP, so a combat air patrol. We were there kind of waiting for them to come in from the east. And they came in, and it was four foxhounds, which was, you know, quite a spectacle to see, all flying in formation. So in echelon, actually. So we intercepted then, did a stern intercept, and came along beside them, and you know, took some photos of them as well, just to properly identify them, and passed that to C2, just following all our protocols, really. None of them really looked at us, which was quite interesting. You know, the curl, the guys who were flying the curl, they would always wave, you know, everyone in the cockpit would be out the window, but these guys were very much stern, looking straight ahead. So that was quite interesting to see. And then we then got told that there was four fullbacks coming. That was we'd been given the heads up. So again, we're like looking at our fuel going, oh, well, we've been airborne for a good kind of 45 minutes now. And they were quite a while to come, but it ended up that we managed to cap again and saved enough fuel that we intercepted the four fullbacks as well, which was an incredible, you know, experience to see these fighters airborne. And same deal as well, they just looked straight ahead. There was no waving from them, but it was, you know, an incredible day, and we managed to escort them, you know, away from the airspace and right down to the south. So yeah, we did a successful, you know, job. We really did complete the task, and with the help of command control and our engineers to get us airborne in time, command control to get us there, you know, and intercept properly, was a very memorable mission. I'll never forget it. Really good.
Finally, what's your favourite thing about the Typhoon?
Favorite thing about the Typhoon is the power, the absolute ferocious power that it has. You know, I put it into context when you're, you know, dogfighting or BFM, or if you're just having a bit of a jolly and you get those 5 minutes where you can go down to low level and you know, and get that experience of the sheer power that it has. So yeah, it's absolutely. Second to that is the way the cockpit is laid out. You know, how much information you get given in a fairly seamless way. It could be better, everything can be, and it's progressing, but it's incredible when it starts to really, it all works in harmony and is all synchronized. It's an impressive bit kit.
Roger chats about his book, Speed of Sound, Sound of Mind.
Definitely what inspired me about writing the book was the loss of my mother back in 2010. She took her own life, and from that completely, as it would, rocked my world and you know, completely changed my perspective, really, on things that were important. And what I realised then was the stigma attached to mental health, and the fact that, you know, people weren't communicating. And indeed, that's probably the case, you know, what happened with my mum as well. And if she had felt more comfortable to speak to people about her own situation, her own mental health, then maybe she'd still be here, you know, today. So it has given me that driving force. And that driving force, and people joking about how I should write a book, you know, with all the kind of the stories that I've got. You've maybe, you know, seen, or we briefly discussed before, I've got 9 pins and a plate in my leg, and I've got 4 metal coils on my face. This from a skiing crash, and then my face from a mountain bike crash. And so that, coupled with the loss of my mum, and, you know, myself and my family having to cope with that loss, then I've certainly got, you know, stuff to talk about. I mean, everyone says they've got a book in them, you know, everyone's got baggage, things have gone wrong, but that's what we really talk about in the book is how to overcome that, how to not just stay positive, that's almost too simple, but how to overcome adversity when things go wrong. But on that note, co-authored the book with Donald McNaughton, who's a sports psychologist. We actually met when I bust my leg, when I smashed up my leg, and I was mandated to go and see this sports psychologist. You know, I wasn't too keen. I didn't really know, I guess, a huge amount about the whole thing, about psychology and how you could use it, you know, to really kind of get the full power of your mind. But actually, when I met him, we got on like a house on fire. and you know, we had a lot in common, and it was really nice just to see how he really did help me, you know, put a positive spin, and it was just really making a way of learning how to control my thoughts and learning how to make them positive, just to drive them the way I wanted to drive them, instead of letting them take control. And just putting a system to my thoughts as well, which in the sporting world is the way to do it. But actually you can take all those skills and take them into anything you do in life as well. And that's what I've found about psychology. It's not sports psychology, yeah, but you can take that into anything. As you discover with the book, how we've actually tried to create a bit of a self-help book to really help people, not just sporting people, not people interested in aviation, but you know, to really give people something that they can really focus on and think about in their own lives as well. But the primary aim of the book is to fight the stigma against mental health, just to get people talking about it, you know, just to make people comfortable to talk about their own mental health, about others, or to know how to help someone else as well. So here I have the book, Speed of Sound, Sound of Mind. And yeah, myself and Don obviously have brought this paper back out a couple of months ago. So we've already sold quite a few, and if you want one, all the profit is going to Help for Heroes and Scots Association of Mental Health. And we've managed to raise, you know, a lot of money so far, which has been fantastic. But if you would like one, then please get in touch with me on facebook.com/speedofsound2016. Just send me a message there, I'll give you the links to where to donate. Basically, at Just Giving, we've got a website set up for that. Also, though, if you've got a Kindle or want an electronic version, then just type Speed of Sound, Sound of Mind, the title of the book, into Amazon, and it'll come up there. And please support us with this great cause, and just help us as a society get better at communicating. You know, simple as that. We can do better, and I think everyone's really starting to talk about mental health, which is the main point. It's fantastic.
So how did the writing process get started?
Yeah, so, you know, being a pilot in the Air Force, we've not got much time. We're pretty busy people. So actually, it was when I went into the Falklands, because we were doing the air policing out there. And I've been out a couple of times now, and I had lots of time to kill, actually, because there you are, you're there on call, and you do, you know, QRA shifts every couple of days or so. So because of that, you're actually sitting around in your rubber suit, ready to go at a moment's notice, like we're talking about before with the QRA type stuff. So actually, I had a lot of time to sit down and write the book out. So I actually managed to write it in a fairly short amount of time, you know, in a couple of months. But then that, with combining forces with Don McNaughton and coming up with a plan of how to best you know, put the book out there, how best advertise it, and how best to structure it as well to make it into a self-help book that's going to help people, but then hopefully an interesting read as well with aviation, some of my stories that you've heard, and my skiing world as well, you know, some stories from the ski racing and how I managed to get to the Olympics, which, trust me, I really didn't think I'd actually managed to qualify because of the broken leg. And then obviously looking into mental health and trying, you know, I've wanted to be very open about what has happened to me and my family and how we coped and what exactly happened with my mum. You know, I still don't have all the answers, but I talk about that and try to share my experience so that others can learn from it, or it can help them through the dark times as well, you know, themselves.
Roger chats about mental health.
I didn't really know much about depression at all before my mother took her own life, and it was, you know, certainly very hard hitting, because you're trying to understand something that is a breadth, isn't it? It's not just a simple like, oh, this is it. You just have to get over it. You just have to stay positive. It's not as simple as that, and it is a very big grey area. And I, you know, didn't understand at the time. I think in hindsight, I knew that my mum was struggling with some things, and there was probably some warning signs there. But then seeing that, you know, before, you know, years before she actually took her own life, I had actually tried to push her to go and talk to someone about it. But she was a nurse, and she was for 40 odd years, you know, so for her, her reply was that, well, how can I go and tell my, you know, the doctor that who I work with closely and have to deal with other people about, you know, how I'm feeling and about my mental state, my mental health. And I see that's what I think is wrong with the society is for her to even feel that. You know, you should have a boss or anyone around you who just will welcome you to talk about your mental health if you are feeling isolated, lonely, depressed, you know, whatever it comes down, because it is a massive topic, which is, it's quite hard to pinpoint. You know, it can be one extreme to the other. So I think for me now, it's not as if I have any qualifications. You know, I stand here talking through experience and only trying to keep it simple, because I think that's, you know, what is important as well. And I think the simple thing is getting people to communicate, and so that us as a society, we feel more comfortable. It makes us more comfortable to talk about it, more confident. So if we have a mental health issue, or if we have something that we're just not sure about, then we can just flag it up to your boss, to your, you know, family, friends. And if not, if you either are not comfortable talking to anyone like that around you, then absolutely just going to get professional help. You know, the amount of organizations out there that you can just pick up the phone and have, you know, a conversation with someone who might be a stranger on the other end of the line, but they're going to have some, you know, good support network structures to give you or to introduce you to, and I think that's really important. Yeah, after my mom took her own life, it was very hard for me to, you know, cope myself, but then trying to look after my sisters, who are both younger than me, but I mean, to be honest, they were probably thinking the same about me, looking after me, but we really had to stay, you know, close together as a close-knit family. So I think that was the most important thing for how to cope with it, was how to stay together as a team and communicate, because we're all having feelings. You go through all sorts of grief, which we talk about in the book, actually, the stages of grief, and how that is very noticeable. You know, you could be angry, sad, confused, and all these things I definitely went through. We all went through as a family, but we're all bouncing off each other and trying to help each other. And what I found, which was fantastically helpful, was my wife, or now wife, she sent me some articles to read from the different organizations, like I think it's from SAMH, of, you know, how to cope with suicide. Because I remember at the time feeling so very isolated, thinking, you know, this doesn't happen to anyone. You know, why has it happened to me, to my family? Why has my mom done it in the first place? And then taking those feelings and reading, you know, what other people have gone through, really, really helped me. And I guess, like we're, you know, saying before, the driving force for writing the book was that feeling that I remember, and thinking, well, feeling so very isolated, but if people can read it, it's for people maybe coping with times when they've lost loved ones to suicide, but it's obviously, I want to prevent that ever happening. So it's to get people thinking about the grief that people can go through, you know, the decision you're making when you're taking your own life, and why not to, you know. And it obviously it can never always be as simple as that, but I think it's just trying to get communication, you know, get people talking and people knowing what it, you know, how to, yeah, to tackle this head on, really, is the main thing, instead of getting isolated and feeling like you're on your own, you've got no one else to talk to. And I think we tried to, you know, talk about that in the book, keeping it positive, because that's what, you know, I want to promote, is trying to put a nice positive spin on this. Yeah, it's a horrible topic, but, you know, I think as a society, it's exciting if we make it so for our next generation that they feel, and this is something that I'm, you know, trying to find the language to talk about, and I mean that. So, you know, if you're a kid, you fall over, you graze your knee, you pretty much know to go and get a plaster, or to ask your mom or your dad for a plaster to sort yourself out. So when it comes to mental health, why isn't it the same thing? You know, like, maybe it is for some people, maybe it is the, you know, the way some parents will talk to their kid and talk them through the feelings. You know, why are you feeling this, or what, how are you feeling? And it's not as simple as, oh, let's, you know, have a hug and talk about our feelings. It's just trying to give kids, for example, our next generation, a way, like a skill set to know how to deal with that. And, you know, a fear of if they fail at something. We fail at, you know, at stuff all our lives, you know, and that's what kind of molds the people we are. It's the people who bounce back from that. You know, I failed at plenty of things, you know, especially in my flight career, and managed to kind of bounce back. So teaching that as a young age, I think, is really, really important. You know, how to deal with loneliness, you know, when you're a kid, and how to just get you know, kids to talk about that, and to teach, and to be, you know, the ideal role models. But to be a role model, you've got to have this information yourself. And you know, I'm saying this now just because of my experience and from my knowing, like your question before, of not knowing anything about mental health until all of a sudden it's on top of you, and this massive, horrible, you know, thing happens with my mom taking her own life. So that's what I'm definitely trying to drive, and trying to get people, yeah, speaking about and feel confident to talk about.
So what charities can you recommend for people to look at or read into or go to?
Yeah, so a really popular one at the moment is Heads Together. I'm sure you've seen Prince William really kind of founding that, and I think that's fantastic, and getting involved with that. And as you know, for me, I'm promoting and giving all the money to Help for Heroes. They've got their own Hidden Wounds, which is like a subset charity. And that really talks about, not specifically PTSD, but it looks into that and, you know, really supports people with that. But it's just talking about how, yeah, that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, horrible injuries that have happened to soldiers, for example, you know, losing limbs and things like that. And it's very obvious now. It's very horrible what happens to them. But when it comes to mental health, it's quite difficult because it can be, yeah, hidden, and hence Hidden Wounds. So, and I really support what Help for Heroes are driving with that. And then Sam H, you know, what Sam H, so Scots Association of Mental Health, and Mind as well, they're very good at getting within the community and giving that support network so that they can be there, or they can have ventures as a community to work together and get people, you know, talking and you know, helping each other out, and that having that support network right there.
So do you think the book helped you getting over your mother's death and coping with the situation?
Yeah, I think it definitely did, because the with me writing the book, it was very therapeutic, you know, to get my feelings out there, it kind of structured and put my way of thinking onto paper. But also as well, because, you know, what a lot of people say when it comes to mental health, to give is very good for your mental health, you know, to give to charity, to help out, to volunteer, all sorts of ways. And for me, you know, being so busy with the Air Force, I've always liked to kind of get involved and volunteer for different things, but I wouldn't have the time. I hate saying that, but I just wouldn't have the time. So I find that this book is a perfect way, you know, to use the good old joys of social media to get it out there, and then to have people reading the book and making it, well, and hopefully it helping them, and just being thought provoking and getting them to talk about mental health has really worked. And so far it's been fantastic. So yeah, that's what we're going for.
And finally, we get to hear more personal side of Roger.
So Roger, do you have any hobbies?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a sporting nut. So I love my cycling, love my skiing. I'm quite into playing the guitar. To be honest, all of that and aviation keeps me busy.
So do you have a favourite TV show?
Favourite TV show, to be honest, anything that involves aviation, again, skiing and cycling, then I'll pretty much watch. So yeah.
Do you ever get to many air shows?
I used to. When I was on the Hawk, then actually we'd get a chance to, you know, go for the weekends. But with the typhoon, yeah, we're all a bit kind of here, there and ever, especially frontline, being very busy, so not much of a chance. But I'm looking forward to, hopefully, in 29 score, maybe get involved a bit more again.
Yeah. Favourite aircraft?
Favourite aircraft has got to be the Spitfire. I think it's maybe what, you know, gave me the absolute ambition to fly when I was young, and maybe being surrounded by my dad watching, you know, the Spitfires and the Hurricanes, World War II aircraft in action, that really became the root of my passion for flying. And I just love the sound of it. I love the look of it. You know, I would love to fly in a Spitfire, but hey, you know, for anyone who's watching, you know, pick me up.
Okay, so what aircraft wish you could have flown if I, you know, I'd went out of service? Is anything there?
Yeah, definitely the Harrier. I think I mentioned before that with the Harrier, it was such, an intricate beast to fly. You know, with a Typhoon, you kind of cheat a bit because you've got all these computers, you know, helping you along. Yeah. But I mean, it is awesome, and it's in different ways. But I think the Harrier would have been an absolute dream to fly. It would have been quite satisfying just to fly the thing in the first place. Yeah.
Do you ever fancy being a display pilot?
Yeah, absolutely. And if the, you know, the situation arises, I'd love to have a shot. I got a taste when I did the Queen's Diamond Jubilee fly past. Oh, so yeah. When we did the E2R in the Hawks, and I was in R, one of those, and I put it on Twitter and things like that. Some of the video clips from there. But doing a bit of display flying that with Gleavy, who was from the Reds, and he was leading the formation. And it was just incredible because you look at it and it was quite polished on the day. But I tell you what, through, you know, trying to get everyone in position for it in the first place and through the rehearsals, because we didn't do that many rehearsals because we didn't have the time or the aircraft, you know, to actually do it. So for us to pull it off on the day, that was, you know, it's an incredible experience and very satisfying as well. Yeah. So I'd love to have a shot.
So what do you get up to when you're not flying?
Sport, yeah, definitely. I love my skiing and my cycling, like I was saying before. So I do quite a bit of ski touring in Scotland. So just getting the skins on the bottom skis, walking up the hills, getting away from all the crowds, and you know, getting to a very serene environment where you can just be there with nothing man-made around you whatsoever. I love that. And I'm adding into my cycling just from all the sports I was doing before. And you know, I do enjoy a bit of competing, you know, sort of do a bit of mountain bike races and a bit of road bike races as well, just because I like that buzz.
Yeah. Do you ever get sick of talking about aviation?
Oh no, not a chance. And that's the worst thing my wife always says about us pilots, is you get us together in a room and that will be it. It is aviation only.
Can you just tell us where you can find you on social media?
Yeah, sure. So on Twitter, you can find me at Rod Cruikshank. So Cruikshank, everyone gets this wrong. It's spelled Cruikshank. And then on Facebook, we've got, it's kind of the hub for the promoting the book, and, you know, talking about mental health and talking about, you know, I try to keep loads of videos on there as well. So that's facebook.com/speedofsound2016. So please look me up and help me, you know, promote the cause of mental health and fight the stigma. And we can all do it together as a society. We just need to get talking and communicate properly.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And don't forget, you can watch and listen to all of our other interviews at aircrewinterview.tv. Also, please sign up to our newsletter for exclusive content, prizes, upcoming interviews, and much more. And of course, go over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us grow and to become part of the team for as little as $1 per month. Thank you, and see you soon.